Hello, this is Cheryl, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 17th issue of the Washington Post on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the headlines, federal judge blasts potential government misconduct in Comey case. A U.S. magistrate judge ordered the Justice Department to release all grand jury material to the former FBI director, saying government misconduct could lead to the dismissal of charges against him. By Jeremy Roebuck. A federal judge excoriated the Justice Department on Monday for its investigation and prosecution of former FBI Director James B. Comey, citing a disturbing pattern of profound investigative missteps and government misconduct that could threaten the viability of the case. U.S. Magistrate Judge William Fitzpatrick ordered prosecutors to swiftly turn over to a judge the full transcripts and audio of the grand jury proceedings that led to Comey's indictment in September on charges that he lied to Congress. Fitzpatrick's 24-page ruling offered a scathing assessment of the criminal case against Comey, which he described as a rushed investigative process that led to the charges, and a cavalier attitude prosecutors and agents appear to have maintained toward Comey's constitutional rights. The Justice Department could appeal Fitzpatrick's order that prosecutors turn over the grand jury material to the district judge overseeing the case. A spokesperson for the department declined to comment Monday. In his ruling, Fitzpatrick acknowledged the unusual nature of his order, which could lead Comey having access to grand jury material, which is typically held secret. But given the prospect that government misconduct may have tainted the grand jury proceedings, disclosure of grand jury materials under these unique circumstances is necessary, the judge said. Fitzpatrick reached that conclusion after reviewing the records of the September grand jury proceedings overseen by Lindsey Halligan, the interim U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, whom President Donald Trump installed in the post after demanding prosecutions of Comey and other foes. Fitzpatrick cited a litany of possible procedural and legal missteps that could provide Comey with a basis to have the indictment thrown out. Among them, the judge said, Halligan, a former personal attorney of Trump's who had no previous prosecutorial experience, appeared to have misstated key aspects of law when instructing the grand jury that indicted Comey. The grand jurors asked Halligan tough questions about the case, Fitzpatrick wrote, and Halligan appeared to suggest that Comey would have to answer those questions himself and explained his innocence at trial. An improper characterization of the government's burden to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. Fitzpatrick also questioned the prosecution team's use of emails and communications seized during a previous investigation of Comey's friend, attorney, and confidant, Daniel Richmond, a law professor at Columbia University. Prosecutors contend that Comey authorized Richmond to serve as an anonymous source to a New York Times reporter to explain his thinking in closing the 2016 investigation into then Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and her use of a personal email server. They allege Comey later lied about that to Congress during a 2020 hearing. The Justice Department obtained search warrants for several of Richmond's personal devices during that previous investigation in 2019 and 2020, which did not result in charges. Halligan's team has sought to use that material in its current case. But Comey's attorneys have raised several objections to the use of that material, noting that some of it may be subject to attorney-client privilege because Richmond has served as a personal attorney to Comey. They have also questioned the government's use of the material from that previous investigation in obtaining the indictment against Comey without first receiving court authorization to do so. Drawing on his review of the Comey grand jury transcripts, Fitzpatrick said Monday that the material seized from Richmond appeared to have been the cornerstone of the prosecutor's presentation to the grand jurors who indicted Comey. If a judge were to later determine they were improperly used, that could further threaten the indictment. This cavalier attitude toward a basic tenet of the Fourth Amendment and multiple court orders left the government unchecked to rummage through all of the information seized from Mr. Richmond, and apparently, in the government's eyes, to do so again anytime they chose, he wrote. And continuing from the headlines, Trump says he would sign measure to release Epstein files if it comes to him. It is unclear whether the Senate would take up the measure if the House passes it. By Mariana Alfaro and Kat Zakharuski. President Donald Trump said Monday he would sign a measure that would require the Justice Department to release information about its investigation into convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and support bills for the legislation a day before the House is scheduled to vote on it. Trump's remarks reinforced a sharp reversal he made late Sunday night when he called on House Republicans to support the measure after resisting such a move for weeks. After days of scrutiny over his personal ties to Epstein, Trump sought to redirect scrutiny to the disgraced financier's relationships with prominent Democrats. "We'll give them everything," Trump told reporters in the Oval Office on Monday. "Let the Senate look at it. Let anybody look at it. But don't talk about it too much because, honestly, I don't want to take it away from us. It's really a Democrat problem." Trump has the authority to direct the Justice Department to release the documents in its possession, as he previously has with documents related to the government investigations into the assassinations of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King Jr. Trump did not explain why he has not taken that step, and the White House did not respond to questions about why the release is contingent on a vote from Congress. The measure, which would compel officials at the Justice Department to release all classified records, documents, communications, and investigative materials relating to the investigation and prosecution of Epstein in its possession, could face hurdles in the Senate. It is not clear whether Majority Leader John Thune, Republican, South Dakota, would bring the measure up for a vote, and Majority Whip John Barrasso, Republican, Wyoming, was noncommittal in an interview Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press. In a response late Sunday to Trump's new stance, Senate Minority Leader Charles E. Schumer, Democrat, New York, said in a post on X, "The vote is to compel you to release them. Let's make this easier. Just release the files now." Before Trump's post on Sunday, Representative Thomas Massie, Republican, Kentucky, who introduced the legislation with Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat, California, suggested that 100 or more House Republicans could vote in favor of releasing the Epstein files this week, despite opposition from Trump. Early resistance from Republican leaders led the two to press for a discharge petition to compel a vote on the matter. "We could have a deluge of Republicans," Massie said on Sunday on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. "I'm hoping to get a veto-proof majority on this legislation when it comes up for a vote." Several Epstein survivors have been increasing the pressure campaign on lawmakers. A group released a video Sunday night through the organization World Without Exploitation to urge people to call their lawmakers to back the vote to release more files. Khanna said House members who have been backing the release of more documents are planning to hold a news conference Tuesday at the Capitol with survivors. The lawmakers are also asking Trump to meet with the women. Until Sunday, the president had been ramping up pressure against the measure, even urging the four Republicans who had signed the discharge petition to remove their names. Trump still insisted that the focus on the Epstein files was a hoax promoted by Democrats, but he said Sunday night that the push to release more documents was distracting the party. "All I do care about is that Republicans get back on point," he wrote on Truth Social on Sunday night. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican, Louisiana, who controls which bills are brought to the floor, had resisted bringing the measure to a vote after it was introduced in July. But after the discharge petition obtained enough signatures last week to compel a vote, he said he is ready to put it before House lawmakers. Still, Johnson tried to downplay the significance of the legislation, saying the Republican-led House Oversight Committee has been releasing more documents than the discharge petition asks for. Last week, the committee made public more than 20,000 pages from the Epstein estate, including several that mention Trump. So the discharge is totally moot. It is a political exercise, and we're going to dispense with that this week, Johnson said on Fox News Sunday. Tensions between Trump and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican, Georgia, one of the four Republicans who backed the discharge petition, have been growing for weeks on issues such as foreign policy and health care subsidies. But on Friday, Trump broke off his support for Greene, saying he would endorse a primary challenger in 2026. The Congresswoman said online that she saw his attacks as a form of backlash over her support of the release of the Epstein files, and the two engaged in several volleys of insults and allegations. On Sunday, Greene told CNN's State of the Union that she didn't understand why Trump was pushing so strongly against the release of more documents, arguing that survivors of Epstein's trafficking have told her that the president did nothing wrong. Trump has not been accused of wrongdoing or taking part in Epstein's sex trafficking operations, and he has denied knowing about the solicitation of underage prostitution before Epstein's 2008 plea. "I'm listening to the women. Those are the ones that are saying that Trump did nothing wrong," Greene said. On Sunday, she also posted on X a letter of support she said she received from 27 Epstein survivors. "We will defend you with everything we have," the woman wrote. The lawmaker from Georgia has also received the backing of the GOP chair in her home district for re-election in 2026 after Trump called Friday for a primary challenger against her. Trump has also said that Epstein's connections with other people and institutions deserve more scrutiny than his relationship with the deceased financier. On Friday, at Trump's request, the Justice Department launched an investigation to examine the relationships between Epstein and several prominent Democrats and donors. Attorney General Pam Bondi quickly tapped federal prosecutors in Manhattan to take on the job. Legal experts raised concerns over the weekend that Trump's demand for a new investigation could give Justice Department officials an excuse not to release all the documents. Greene told CNN that even though Trump is attacking her, she wants him to be successful for the American people. Greene also said she hopes that she and the president can resolve their falling out. "I do support him and his administration, and I support them in delivering the campaign promises we made to the American people," she said. Those promises, she said, include the release of the Epstein files. From the health section, Trump slashed spending on clinical trials. The toll is starting to become clear. Grants for 383 clinical trials were terminated, and the funding disruptions affected more than 74,000 trial participants, according to new research. By Allison Chu. Amy Nunn and Philip Chan had just started to enroll participants in a federally funded clinical trial for HIV prevention when their work came to an abrupt halt in early March. "I panicked," said Nunn, CEO of the nonprofit Rhode Island Public Health Institute, whose research was focused on Black and Hispanic men and their use of the preventative medication for HIV known as pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PREP. "Prep. I was worried we might lose everything." Their study was one of many clinical trials that lost funding this year after the Trump administration slashed millions in National Institutes of Health grants. From the end of February to August, grants for 383 clinical trials were terminated, and the funding disruptions affected more than 74,000 trial participants, according to new research published Monday in JAMA Internal Medicine. The analysis marks the latest effort to quantify the impact of the large-scale research funding cuts that were initiated soon after President Donald Trump took office. The administration has told scientists that it is ending certain work considered discriminatory against people based on race, sex, religion, or other attributes, and stopping funding to prevent wasteful spending. One argument is that a large motivation for canceling and reducing a lot of the research budget was to reduce the amount of unnecessary research or low-quality research, said Vishal Patel, the new study's lead author and a physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. But clinical trials are the pinnacle of scientific research. Approximately 1 in 30 trials lost funding, according to the study. While Patel noted that it's unclear how many trials had funding pulled retroactively before the slew of cuts that began in February, he said instances appeared to be rare. The researchers found that the cuts disproportionately affected trials focused on infectious diseases such as COVID-19 and HIV, prevention, and behavioral interventions. More than 100 of the canceled grants were for cancer research. Grant terminations also affected studies conducted outside the United States more than domestic trials. The NIH did not provide comment before publication. The study's findings support concerns raised by many researchers and public health experts. It's not surprising, and it's seriously emblematic of the problem that we're seeing with this kind of take a sledgehammer to all things health approach of the administration, said Susan Polin, Associate Executive Director for Public Affairs and Advocacy with the American Public Health Association. The association sued the Trump administration to restore terminated NIH grants. Robert Hopkins, medical director for the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases, said the study showed that funding cuts disproportionately hit areas that are critical to public health. Clinical research is a long game, he said. Developing new vaccines, antivirals, and treatments takes years, often decades. Cutting funding now risks slowing progress on interventions that could help save lives for years to come. Chan said another trial he was heading, which focused on mental health in the LGBTQ community, also lost funding. That study, he said, was 6 months away from ending. Monday's paper really highlights some of the disruptions in research in academia and really highlights how this has affected our infrastructure and our ability to conduct research, said Chan, chief medical officer at the Rhode Island Public Health Institute and an associate professor of medicine at Brown University. After the NIH funding was canceled for the PrEP trial, Nunn said, she had to stop enrolling people at two sites. Work at a third site continued only because she was able to cobble together money from non-federal sources. Nunn and Chan said the funding for these two trials, which were designed for about 200 to 300 participants, has since been reinstated after a federal judge in Massachusetts ordered the Trump administration to restore hundreds of canceled scientific research grants. But many public health researchers remain wary. The Supreme Court in August sided with the Trump administration, allowing cuts to nearly $800 million in NIH grants for studies on diseases in minority, gay, and transgender communities. The new study's count of trials that lost grants includes those that got their funding back, Patel said. He and other researchers emphasized that even delays during trials could have profound impacts on the studies and participants. If you pause an experiment, especially when it comes to experiments involving drugs and patients where you need a consistent dose over time and consistent measurements, it's possible that you just screwed up the entire research, Patel said. During the time that the PrEP study wasn't receiving federal funding, Nunn said, one of the sites, a clinic in Jackson, Mississippi, closed. Efforts are now underway to get the site back up and running. A lot of clinical infrastructure was crippled or crushed because of the grant terminations, and it's hard to build it back, she said. When clinical trials are delayed or canceled, patients are also often losing access to care, Chan said. I firmly believe that some of those folks got HIV, he said, of people who were not able to participate in the PrEP trial. Future research, he said, should aim to get a better understanding of how people were affected by the cancellations. Many other studies that are not clinical trials also lost funding. A May study published in JAMA Internal Medicine found that between February and April, nearly 700 NIH grants were terminated across 24 of the federal agency's 26 institutes and centers. Nunn and other experts raised concerns that canceling studies could lead to fewer scientific advancements. The reason all of those 383 trials were funded is because people believe they have novel solutions to important public health questions, Nunn said, adding that not all of the studies had their funding restored. The knowledge that we would have had about how we can enhance population health through those clinical trials will be lost. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Washington Post on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the Opinion section by Jim Garrity. The first glimpse of post-Trump MAGA has arrived. With a push from Marjorie Taylor Greene, Donald Trump acquiesces over the Jeffrey Epstein files. No, you don't need to give Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene the strange new respect treatment because during the recent government shutdown fight, the Georgia Republicans sided with Democrats supporting an extension of Obamacare subsidies. Or even if she seems to have forced President Donald Trump on Sunday night to surrender on a legislative effort to require the Justice Department to unseal all of its documents relating to Jeffrey Epstein. In the shutdown standoff, Greene emphasized that she thinks health insurance and all insurance is a scam, and she's still on the same loon known for ranting about secret Jewish space lasers and false flag mass shootings, and last month claiming all our country does is fund foreign countries and foreign wars and never does anything to help the American people. Similarly, don't assume anything good about Greene just because she triggered and seemingly won the online brawl with Trump over the Epstein files. But the fracas does merit close attention because Greene is demonstrating that a high-profile member of the MAGA movement can vehemently disagree with the president and apparently emerge unscathed. If she pulls this off, she'll show that Trump may no longer be the kingmaker in Republican primaries or in the MAGA crusade. Oh, look, it's a road sign saying, Lame Duckville, next three exits. In recent days, Greene angered the White House not only by siding with Democrats on Obamacare subsidies, but also by telling NBC News that Trump has abandoned his America First priorities and, perhaps most consequentially, by pushing for the Epstein documents release. Apparently, that was the last straw for the president, who raged on Truth Social last week that he was withdrawing his support and endorsement of Greene. I can't take a ranting lunatic's call every day. I understand that wonderful conservative people are thinking about primarying Marjorie in her district of Georgia, that they are too fed up with her and her antics, and if the right person runs, they will have my complete and unyielding support. She has gone far left, even doing The View with their low IQ Republican-hating anchors. It is revealing that Greene's wanting to release documents about Epstein, not her Obamacare defense, is what prompted Trump to conclude she is far left. You might have thought that once Trump denounced her, other Georgia Republicans would line up to take a whack at Greene, but Jim Tully, chairman for the GOP in her district, offered the local party's full and unwavering support on X, lauding her uncompromising dedication to the principles that define both our district and our nation. And then Sunday night, in a sudden reversal, Trump declared on Truth Social that House Republicans should vote to release the Epstein files because we have nothing to hide. He insisted he wanted the files released to get Republicans back on point on the economy. Tucked into the northwest corner of the state, Georgia's 14th district is most heavily Republican one, scoring an R plus 19 in the Cook Partisan Voting Index. If there's any dissatisfaction with Green among Republicans there, it has been well hidden. Green was unopposed in the 2024 primary. In the 2022 GOP primary, she won with 69.5% of the vote, despite facing five challengers. Of course, as your financial advisor should be telling you, past performance is no guarantee of future results. Perhaps Trump will find a strong challenger to Green. Another Trump acolyte, Laura Loomer, posted on X, "Should I buy a house in Rome, Georgia? Do you think President Trump would endorse me?" In 2020, Trump attacked Georgia's Republican governor, Brian Kemp, because Kemp didn't buy into the president's absurd stolen election conspiracy theories. Trump even recruited former Senator David Perdue to run against Kemp in the 2022 primary. But Kemp, who ignored the president's broadsides and emphasized his record of accomplishment, whomped Perdue 73% to 21%. The difference between then and now is that Kemp was and is a traditional conservative whose philosophy predates the MAGA movement. Green, on the other hand, is MAGA through and through, and so far she's demonstrating you can disagree with Trump and emerge relatively unscathed. In an interview with Laura Ingraham on Fox News last week, Trump warned, "Don't forget, MAGA was my idea. MAGA was nobody else's idea. I know what MAGA wants better than anybody else." Green put that claim to the test and forced Trump to reverse his position. Green may be a lunatic, as the president says, but she's a lunatic who's looking down the road and positioning herself for the day Donald Trump no longer enjoys unfettered power over Republican politics. From the style section, would your partner pass the bird test? It's complicated, experts say. Two relationship experiments are flying high on TikTok, but they aren't exactly foolproof. By Samantha Cherry. "Oh my gosh, I forgot to tell you on the phone. I saw a bird today," Brooke Phillips chirped to her husband, Donovan. She was secretly recording their interaction as he walked around their home in his military uniform and backpack. "Wow, what kind of bird?" he replied in a monotone, adding two unenthused "hell yeahs" before walking out of frame. The 18-second video, which has been viewed nearly 1 million times on TikTok since Phillips uploaded it in October, convinced some commentators that Donovan had failed the bird test, or bird theory, a viral relationship test that has seen a resurgence in popularity in the past month. To perform the bird test, one partner mentions a seemingly insignificant occurrence, seeing a bird, to their significant other in the hopes that they'll express interest and maybe ask some follow-up questions. But if the partner seems uninterested or dismisses their partner completely, the response is said to be a warning signal that their relationship might need some work. That's the theory, at least. But as the research behind it shows, the test isn't foolproof. Even partners in the most solid relationships won't pass every time, and vice versa. Social media has also muddled the science behind the test, with waves of commentators making inaccurate assumptions based on short clips, some of which might be staged. Some who watched Phillips' video came to her husband's defense. "He's military, doesn't count. Mine is broken too," one wrote, with others suggesting he wasn't up for bird talk because he was running late for work. Brooke and Donovan giggled as they scrolled through the comments of strangers trying to scrutinize their marriage and getting almost every detail wrong, she told the Washington Post. She wasn't concerned by Donovan's lukewarm response, she said, because her husband is used to hearing random details about her day and enduring her pranks. If the experiment taught her anything, it was to not take the internet too seriously. "I learned so much more about how to guard my heart and my husband's heart from the world," she said, "as opposed to learning about what my husband thinks about me and our relationship and what he thinks about birds." Videos of people trying to out the bird test spread widely across TikTok last year, along with the orange peel theory, where experimenters asked their partners to peel an orange for them. This year, the tests have reached a larger audience, even catching the attention of the Philadelphia Eagles, which had a defense tackle, Jalen Carter, try out the trend on his teammates. Despite the stir some of the videos have caused online, John Gottman, a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Washington, whose research on marriage and relationships inspired the tests, has been pleased to see so many people discussing and embracing the experiment online. We only think of connection in terms of dramatic things like, how is my partner going to respond when I get a diagnosis of breast cancer, Gottman said. We think of these big moments, but it's really in the tiny moments that the connection is built. The bird and orange theories are rooted in what Gottman calls a bid for connection. In 1992, Gottman and a team of researchers observed 130 newlywed couples for 6 years in a quest to determine what makes a relationship sink or soar. Through the study, the psychologists found a marked difference in how often partners engaged with or turned toward their partners after receiving low-stake questions or comments. The couples that were still married after the 6 years had turned toward each other an average of 86% of the time, whereas the couples who ended up divorcing only accepted bids for connection 33% of the time on average. One failed test doesn't necessarily mean a relationship is doomed. Sometimes somebody's just involved in what they are reading and they literally don't hear the bid or they don't pay attention to it because their attention is focused elsewhere. That's not really a very good test, Gottman said. It has to be a consistent pattern. And so becoming aware of these moments is the important thing. As couples post their experiments, the tests have spread awareness and helped make research findings from Gottman and his wife Julie common knowledge. Audra Nuru, a professor at the University of St. Thomas, appreciates that the tests have made relationship science more accessible and shown people how intimacy is built on the mundane. But she stressed that relationships are complex and the test doesn't always have a clear pass or fail as the internet discourse makes it seem. And then there's the theory matter of turning your relationship dynamics into social media content. There's something really tender and vulnerable about these videos, which is why they resonate so deeply, Nuro said. But when someone shares their partner's reaction, they're inviting the world into a genuinely intimate moment. And so what might begin as a private moment between these two people becomes culled by a much wider audience. Others are now helping define its meaning. One of the most popular orange peel test videos had some viewers seeing red. When Shelby Wilfong asked her boyfriend Tino Zach to pry open an orange for her in a January 2024 video, he went on a tirade telling Wilfong, "Tough luck, buddy, and you're not even that special." "I beg your finest pardon," one commenter wrote. Others reacted with red flag emojis, while another viewer chimed in, "My husband of 30 years would be happy to peel an orange for me, and me for him. Leave now." Wilfong and Zach, who appeared to still be together, declined to be interviewed. Interestingly enough, Zach posted a video on the same day using the orange peel theory to test his girlfriend. She too failed the challenge, telling him she's barely attracted to him. Real or rage bait? You be the judge. The authenticity of the videos isn't always easy to parse. Madison Humphrey, a content creator and actress who has grown a following of more than 4 million parroting some of the quirkiest relationship clips on the internet, said she decided against reenacting a bird theory video because she couldn't tell whether it was a skit. The tricky part of social media is that it's not reality, and you don't see the 24/7 feed of whoever's video you're watching at that time, Humphrey said. There's a lot of context clues that you could be missing. Instead of dissecting someone else's relationship, Nuru hopes people are inspired by the videos to talk about and think of ways to turn toward their partners, even without birds or oranges. Relationships don't really come with instruction manuals or predetermined meaning, and so partners are creating that meaning together through how they listen and how they respond and how they choose to matter to each other, Neuro said. That meaning isn't handed to us. We create it together in those small moments. It's how we communicate, and it's how we choose to honor and the way we show up for each other that defines that relationship. And I would really hate for people to think that one test would outweigh that. From the business section, how TikTok came to rival eBay as a global online shopping destination. After starting in the U.S. just 2 years ago, TikTok Shop could sell up to $15 billion in merchandise to Americans this year, analysts say. By Jacqueline Pizer. Despite tariff chaos and rising grocery costs, consumers are more willing than ever to impulse buy Swedish candy, embroidered sweatshirts, and Korean skincare on TikTok, lifting the company to a category rivaling eBay. In its third quarter alone, TikTok Shop sold $19 billion worth of merchandise globally, according to recent data from analytics firm Ecotech. That's just slightly below the total for eBay, founded 3 decades ago, which posted $20.1 billion. A combination of aggressive marketing and shifting consumer preferences have boosted TikTok Shop's success, says analysts and researchers. Another factor was a lucky break for TikTok when Chinese e-commerce sites lost a shipping loophole that kept prices low. And it's not slowing down, especially in the United States, where it started up 2 years ago after expanding abroad, said Josas Kazanoukias, an independent e-commerce analyst. The company sold $4 billion to $4.5 billion worth of products here in its third quarter, the most of any country, and a 125% quarter-over-quarter increase, according to Ecotech. Although TikTok does not publicly release specific sales figures, it reported that U.S. sales in the first half of the year were up 120% year-over-year. Patrick Nomanson, head of TikTok Shop Strategic Initiatives in the Americas and European Union, said in a statement that the operation has more impact than traditional online shopping or social commerce. We created an experience where buyers genuinely want to shop, not because of who they follow, but because they've discovered products they truly connect with, Nomanson said. Kazanoukias, in an analyst note this month, projected that the company will top $15 billion worth of sales in the U.S. in 2025, which is a lot considering the sales channel didn't exist 2 years ago, and given that there have been lingering questions about the app's status in the United States. This shows the potential of social commerce when it's part of a social network that is massive, and it also shows that clearly the ceiling is not reached, he said in an interview. It will only get bigger if more brands and more users get comfortable with it. TikTok Shop also has a live shopping feature that's picking up some traction among U.S. users, although not as much as its parent company, ByteDance, expects. Overall, the company is still struggling to translate the wildly popular experience of live shopping in Asia to the U.S. According to a report from Global Data, in partnership with TikTok Shop, about 10% of consumers had purchased something from live stream in the last 12 months ending in April. Impulse buys with a side of narrative. When the company rolled out TikTok Shop in 2023, in the run-up to the biggest shopping season of the year, it did a full court press of its shopping content into Uyghur's algorithms, a move meant to kickstart the market, Kazanoukias said. The company offered discounts of up to 60% off with a second stackable code for another 20% off, all in an effort to draw in users. The initial push has paid off. Shoppers over the 2024 Black Friday Cyber Monday weekend sales surged 165% year over year, Nomensen said. Sales on Black Friday alone reached $100 million, triple that of 2023. This year's sale event started Wednesday and extends through Cyber Monday. Despite initial outcry from users over the deluge of shoppable content, growth over the past year has been more organic. A recent report from Morning Consult shows TikTok Shop is one of the fastest growing brands among all American consumers. That growth really corresponds and correlates with a time where we are seeing more consumers shop via social media apps on a regular basis, said Bobby Blanchard, a senior director of audience development at Morning Consult. The app has also radically shifted how consumers discover products. As opposed to shopping on Amazon, a more functional e-commerce site, buying on TikTok can be more serendipitous. A small treat, said Neil Saunders, a managing director at retail analytics firm Global Data. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. Unlike its social media counterparts, the TikTok algorithm seamlessly sprinkles in branded content or influencers' ad posts in between cat and dance videos. They are going on to be entertained, and then they're discovering products or brands they didn't know existed, and they're buying it, Saunders said. Gen Z and Gen Alpha consumers in particular are unbothered by the sponsored posts, said Babson College marketing professor Lauren Biedelsbacher. When it comes to influencers, she said, the parasocial relationship allows them to believe that the influencer wouldn't associate themselves with a brand they didn't agree with. Lucy Robertson, the global head of brand marketing at Buttermilk, an influencer agency, noted that the most effective TikTok shop creators are those who build narratives around their recommendations. You're not just watching them show a product, you're watching them use it, react to it, and integrate it into their lifestyle. This is particularly true in the beauty category, where creators show followers how to apply contour or blush or how to apply their skincare at night. Sales of Korean beauty products alone surged 132%, according to data provided by the company. In July through September, creator-driven beauty sales more than doubled year over year, and there are 3.3 billion views of videos with hashtag skincare routine, one of the most popular hashtags in the category. Men are also getting hooked. In September, viewership of videos about fragrance, a category that continues to grow in part because of men's purchases, was 60% male, company data showed. Analysts say some of the sales uptick could also be attributed to the falling appeal of Temu and Shein among U.S. shoppers after the removal of the de minimis exemption that allowed imports worth less than $800 to enter the country duty-free. Among top sellers on TikTok Shop are less recognizable brands making cheaper goods. It happens to be super cheap, Kazunuka said, and it becomes a much better impulse buy. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Washington Post on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the tech section, he bought a subscription online but had to cancel by snail mail. Some people are frustrated over trying to quit Dropbox subscriptions. Why is fighting unwanted subscriptions such a pervasive problem? Analysis by Shira Ovid. It took Jonathan Ginsberg hours of work over 2 years to cancel his subscription to Dropbox. After he was charged $119.88 last year to renew the online file storage subscription that he had lost interest in, Ginsberg said that he hit dead ends trying to quit on Dropbox's website. No one seemed to answer the customer service number. He eventually disputed the charge with his credit card company and followed Dropbox's instructions to mail printed cancellation documents to a P.O. box. Then a few months ago, Dropbox emailed Ginsburg about a failed payment for a subscription that he thought had been canceled. He fought again and wasn't charged. I did kind of beat them, but it took a hell of a lot of effort, said the 58-year-old St. Petersburg, Florida resident. Ginsburg isn't the only one wrestling over a Dropbox subscription. The Bay Area's Better Business Bureau has been investigating the San Francisco company for what BBB has said is a pattern of unresolved customer complaints, partly about difficulties quitting paid Dropbox accounts. A Dropbox spokeswoman apologized for Ginsburg's experience and said that the BBB complaints were not representative of Dropbox's customer interactions or its simple cancellations. Experience like Ginsburg's show that fighting over unwanted subscriptions is a maddening fact of life. The frustrations persist despite decades of federal and state consumer protection efforts that focused on subscriptions. Why do subscriptions sometimes feel so impossible to quit, and what can you do to protect yourself? Contacting them is impossible. When companies have millions of customers, Dropbox discloses about 18 million paying business and personal users and more than 700 million registered users. Some of them will be unhappy. The BBB says that investigations like the one into Dropbox customer complaints happen all the time. Among the more than 250 public complaints about Dropbox posted on the BBB's website over 3 years, many people said they got the runaround with canceling subscriptions, were charged after quitting, or couldn't reach the company for help. Contacting them is impossible, one person wrote in January. Another said in 2023 that Dropbox seems to hold people prisoner. Ginsburg couldn't believe that he had used the 250-year-old U.S. Postal Service to reach a Silicon Valley company. Samuel Levine, a former director of the Federal Trade Commission's Consumer Protection Bureau, wasn't impressed either. A company that specializes in providing people with high-tech tools should not be forcing people to use 18th-century technology to cancel their subscriptions, Levine said. Mr. Ginsburg's experience didn't live up to our high standards, and we're sorry, the Dropbox spokeswoman said. The company is in active discussions with the BBB about its review, she said, and added that many BBB complaints were duplicates of those that Dropbox customer service had already resolved. The spokeswoman said canceling Dropbox takes a few clicks online, or people can cancel by mail if they really can't do so online. We care deeply about our customers' experience with our services, and that includes those who may want to cancel their subscriptions, she said. What you can do to protect yourself. Trapping people in subscriptions is illegal, but there are pervasive complaints about businesses doing so. The FTC has reported receiving many thousands of yearly complaints from people who said they felt tricked into signing up for subscriptions or jumped through hoops to quit. When Levine was at the FTC, the agency passed a click-to-cancel rule that mandated businesses make it easy for people to quit recurring subscriptions as it was to sign up. Business groups sued, and a federal court blocked the rule this summer. The FTC has said that it can and does enforce violations of existing subscription laws. Levine said that those actions have helped, but not enough. Levine said that canceling subscriptions is often intentionally maddening, and people shouldn't blame themselves if they hit roadblocks. Companies should be ashamed of these practices, and policymakers should be using every tool they have to put a stop to them, he said. If you have trouble canceling a subscription or feel you were unfairly charged for one, try to resolve the disagreement with the company first. You can dispute the charge with your credit card provider. Also, file a complaint with the Better Business Bureau. You must provide proof of your dealings with the company. BBB can be a middleman in resolving disputes with businesses, though this process can take time. Filing a BBB complaint can be useful beyond your situation. Experts say that regulators include the FTC look at BBB complaints to help spot patterns of potential legal violations. Also, look for signs of unresponsive businesses before you sign up. A BBB spokeswoman, Melanie McGovern, advised reading complaints with an eye to how businesses resolve them or don't. Also, cancel before you forget. You sometimes know that you want a subscription for just a week, month, or year. You can often cancel the subscription as you sign up and use the subscription until it expires. Complain to the FTC or your state attorney general. The FTC's online complaint form doesn't have a subscription-specific category. Choose something else if that's the best fit. Search online for your state and attorney general file complaint. New York and California residents have particularly strong protections against deceptive subscriptions. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 17th issue of the Washington Post. Your reader has been Cheryl. Thank you for listening.